Counsel.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Proceed.
If it please the court, my name is Nelson Happy. I'm the attorney for all of the appellants. Mr. Robert Krinsky, who represents the DeFrangs, is also here in the courtroom with me. This case has been here before. The first time the trial judge granted summary judgment in our favor, this court reversed and remanded the case back for consideration of facts which were developed in the lower court, which I'll discuss in a minute. And the court also granted summary judgment this time for the other side. So we're asking this court to reverse the trial judge's summary judgment in favor of the other side, to exercise its de novo review of the record, and to grant summary judgment in our favor at this time.
Was there a pending motion for summary judgment on your side, and you're appealing the denial of it?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're crossing. Normally review the denial of a motion for summary judgment.
Well, technically, what we're really doing is appealing the grant of the motion of summary judgment for the other side.
And then we would normally just remand it to the trial court for further proceedings.
I would hope that the court could exercise its jurisdiction to just review the record de novo and enter final judgment, because a great deal of time and resources have been spent on the case, and if possible, it would be a lot better, I think, for all the parties to have it finally resolved based on this record. But obviously, that's the court's decision. I'm going to, first of all, discuss the three specific issues that this court remanded the case to be determined, and then I would like to hit 4 points. First, the unrebutted extrinsic evidence that the court asked us to adduce shows that the other side did not comply with the bylaws of Island Landmarks, and therefore their attempt to hold a meeting and to replace the board was ineffective. Secondly, they did not comply with the bylaws with respect to both section 2.5 and 2.7, because at the time the notices were given, they were not members of Island Landmarks, and the people to whom they gave notice were not members of Island Landmarks either. The third point is related to the fact that Washington courts abstained from reviewing nonprofit corporations' interpretation of its own bylaws unless the corporation's interpretation is arbitrary and unreasonable. And finally, Washington courts also abstained from compelling a voluntary association to admit members the association does not want. Now, let me go back to the three points that this court asked to be considered on remand for factual extrinsic evidence. The first was, were the Chrisman Group members entitled to vote who could call a special meeting pursuant to Section 2.5? Second, who is a member of record, and whether notice was given to each member of record as required by the first portion of Section 2.7? And the third, did the Chrisman Group comply with Section 4.9 when it deposits checks directly into the Island Landmark bank account without the knowledge and approval of the treasurer? Now, the first point is that the unrebutted extrinsic evidence shows that the Chrisman Group did not comply with the bylaws of Island Landmarks. The extrinsic evidence that was adduced at trial to show, or in the motion for summary judgment, to determine what the interpretation of the Island Landmarks board was at the outset of the beginning of the corporation, which is the reason that the case was remanded, this court asked, what was the interpretation at the outset? The extrinsic evidence consisted of three different types of evidence. The first begins with clerk papers 1579, and it's an illustration of how the membership application was prepared and given to members. In the membership application, there was a provision for a payment of dues and a return of the membership application to the Island Landmarks post office box. And that was done
the bylaws that defines membership, isn't it fairly explicit? It's open, it's unlimited, and you have to pay $25 annually.
Your Honor, if that's for the application.
You have to have some interest in this historical preservation and so forth.
That's in order to apply, you have to have that. But then there's more steps after that. The bylaws require more things.
And where do you find those steps?
Well, it's in 2.7 and 2.5.
Okay.
There's two issues. You've got to first have your name put down on the register of the corporation so that you the secretary can know who the member is. And the second is that dues have to be collected by the treasurer and deposited in the bank account by the treasurer.
Why wouldn't it be fair to say that those are duties that are incumbent upon the secretary and on the treasurer, but that they don't really bear up on what a member is when the bylaw explicitly defines what a member is?
Well, a member of record, Your Honor, would have to be somebody that was of record. And that is that they would have to have their name on the rolls of the corporation.
Bylaws in order to distinguish between members and members of record?
Yes, members of record are the people that are entitled to vote. So unless you're a member of record, you're not entitled to vote. And I also believe...
So you can be a member without being a member of record?
I don't believe you can, Your Honor. I think that the two are interchangeable.
My first question, they don't make that distinction, either a member or not a member.
Well, in my opinion, using the extrinsic evidence as a basis for it, the corporation always required that the name of the person be recorded in the register of the corporation and recorded. And that makes good sense, because how can a corporation or a not-for-profit function if it doesn't know the name of its members or who they are, their address? How can they possibly know? Here there was essentially a parallel universe created where over here was the real corporation that had real members, real officers and directors, and over here was another entity that no one knew who they were. They didn't have there was no way to access their names.
There was some record or list of members other than the new members that purported to join the organization?
Yes, Your Honor. The existing, in the record, you will find that in the extrinsic evidence, that you can... Look, there were three different types of ways that the corporation...
Oh, my question is, well, I think there was a discovery request, was there not, for a list of members? And was that membership list ever provided?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. In fact, it's in the record, the membership list, which the court asked for to see how the corporation did it, includes index cards, a database, and also follow-up records where individuals were named and what they did, and so that the employees of the not-for-profit could keep in touch with those people. Okay. So that was all 100% of the time.
You answered my question.
And I think that's important for the court to review that extrinsic evidence to see how the Island Landmarks always...
You're using your reserved time.
Okay, Your Honor, I will just...
Which is fine if you want to use it up, but the clock's still running.
I think I'll go ahead and wait for the reserved time, Your Honor.
Your Honors, my name is David Brenner. I represent the plaintiff in the lawsuit and the respondent on this appeal, Island Landmarks, and the board that was elected by the members on June the 4th, 2012, almost 4 years ago. Indeed, a lot of time has passed in this lawsuit. What's at stake is a unique Japanese farm on Vashon Island, a farm with a garden established by a Japanese pioneer woman, and with a commercial enterprise and bottling process that became the means by which strawberries would be.
Said in the previous case, I think we sort of understand the background.
Thank you, Your Honor. I emphasize that because preservation is what this is about, an important organization. Mr. Happy just referred to parallel universes. I think the real problem here is a black hole versus an active membership-based corporation, an active universe, because that's what the discovery when this case was remanded ended up showing. This court had three issues that Mr. Happy's already described, remanded on issues of fact after the court found that old board's interpretation of the notice provision and how you give notice was unreasonable. And those questions were membership, what's a member entitled to vote, who's a member of record, and were all those persons given appropriate notice. Our discovery focused on three periods. One was the mid-1990s, which was the time at which this corporation was incorporated. The second was the summer of 2010, which was the last time that the corporation under the respondents was active. And the third was May, June 2012, when the new members, 70 new members, appeared. In the mid-90s, the discovery at that point went to what was intended by the phrase you just referenced, Judge Spearman, open and unlimited members. And the person who spoke to that was the attorney for the incorporators, Frederick Kutcher. Mr. Kutcher filed a declaration saying it was intended to be broad-based. He based that on his general recollection, the checklist that he had from the incorporation, and his practice at the time. It was to have a broad base, and there was no basis for rejecting any member who showed up and fulfilled the qualifications of being a member. There were two requirements to be a member, as you just referenced. One was to pay $25 in dues. That never changed. And the second was to express an interest in the mission of Island Landmarks to preserve this landmark. And that took the form of a very simple application. Those were the only requirements, expression of interest and payment of dues. It's exactly what happened later with the members who I represent.
But you had to deliver that application somewhere.
They were offered in this case in 2012 at the time of the meeting to the former secretary of the corporation. I think you're absolutely correct in the point that was a question, inference of the question just asked, that the secretary and the treasurer functions were ministerial acts. There was no role for judgment. And Attorney Kutcher testified to that as well. So they had an obligation to receive those funds and to take the names. And what happened here was exactly the opposite.
So if I had deposited $25 into their bank account and done nothing more, just sat at home, I was a member.
Well, I think you needed to express an interest, whether...
So I filled out a form that said I'm interested, but I retained that form.
Mm-hmm. I think actually the payment would probably be an inherent expression of interest because you'd have to know about the landmark. And in this case, a form was filled out and it was offered to the former secretary.
Doesn't the intent have to be communicated before I become a member?
I think it was included in the deposit of the checks, because that actually informed the corporation, in the only way really possible at this time, other than offering these to DeFrank.
And was the notice of the meeting sent out before those membership forms were tendered and the checks deposited?
The notice was sent out on, I believe, the 11th day before the meeting, received by the secretary on the 10th day. That was appropriate. And then the telephone call in which the applications were offered to the secretary was on the 9th day. So contrast that with what happened in...
So they weren't members. They hadn't tendered their applications as members prior to initiating a notice alleging to be members calling a special meeting.
Now, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the submission of the checks and the provision of the notice to the secretary were sufficient to identify all 70 people before the 10th day.
Why isn't the deposit of the money equally consistent with someone just wanting to contribute money to a good cause? I write checks to charities all the time without intending to become a member of the organization.
In this case, by the 10th day, the secretary and the president and treasurer knew through the notice they weren't entitled to get, but they did get, that there were 70 members who wanted to be members, not just make a contribution.
Was it enough to want to be, or do you have to get through the hoops? I mean, one way to read all of these bylaws is to say there are two things you have to do. You have to give us $25, and you have to give us this written form we've developed that's the way we understand you're expressing interest.
The written form had not been used for 15 years or 12 years at that time.
Is there any evidence that somebody had joined without submitting a form?
There was evidence that somebody had tried to join in this dead period between 2010 and 2012 by asking, how do I join? They wrote to Ms. Matthews, the president in Texas, at her address, never heard back. So that's why the 2010 period...
That folks had joined without paying the $25?
The $25 was assessed in 2010 by the old board, when they tried to, when they realized in response to the Attorney General's query about what's happening with this corporation and what's going on with your governance, Ms. Matthews asked her friend Priscilla Beard to find us some members, and Ms. Beard paid the dues for the people she then wrote to and said, I have a friend in trouble, and would you join this landmark, this nonprofit, by sending back a proxy statement that elects a new board. Didn't actually request any kind of indication of interest in the mission of the landmark or anything. And at that point, based on that, all happened on day two before a meeting. Day one before the meeting, the proxies went out, and then the meeting happened that ostensibly elected the board that then did nothing from that point on.
Who paid the $25 for these folks? Ms. Beard, or did they themselves pay it?
Ms. Beard paid the $25. So that's what happened in 2010. Our discovery showed we were interested in whether there was a list as well. We certainly did get lists, very long, active lists from 1995, 1997, when this was actually functioning as a membership-based nonprofit. In 2010, what we learned was that there was no list actually created until after the members' meeting. The people who were on that list had expressed no interest. These are the standards to which they were holding themselves in 2010. And my reference to a dark hole is what happened after that, because there were no annual meetings on the 2 years that there were supposed to occur, the specific date in the bylaws. There were no board meetings. There were no member solicitations. There were no members' dues solicited or obtained. We got bank records, and we got admissions on the record to that effect. And the corporation lapsed because they didn't even file the annual report with the Secretary of State. So what these new members came to in May of 2012 was indeed a corporate black hole. Nothing had come out of that hole for 18 months. And
was there in fact a board, a constituted board at that point?
You know? I don't believe so, Your Honor, because there's no board that had been elected in the two annual meetings that should have occurred but didn't occur. There was no corporation left because it had lapsed. I mean, it was just dead. And so what these people did was the best thing they could do under the circumstances. They clearly read the bylaws, and they moved forward. First they canvassed the island and came up with members, people who genuinely wanted to support this landmark. They asked each of those to write a check for $25 that would show the name and the address and all the information needed for the corporation to be able to identify those members. And then because Ms. Matthews had not responded at all, she was in Texas, to this inquiry that had happened a few months before, they took the best step they could. Former treasurer gave them the account number, and the bank gave them the new account number and accepted the checks into the account 11 days before the meeting. They were identified to the corporation. That's the language that the attorney who incorporated the corporation said member of record means, identified to the corporation on that date. Then on 9 days before, this phone call occurred in which those actual applications with the expression of interest were given, and DeFrank denied them. And that's the Eastlake case, Your Honor. The Eastlake case absolutely applies and governs. Thank you for your time.
If it pleases the court, I have to correct the record immediately from some of Mr. Brenner's comments. He said that 9 or 10 days before the meeting, that the Secretary of Island Landmarks was given copies of the membership form. This is absolutely not true. At no time did anybody give the Secretary of Island Landmarks the membership forms. And in fact,
I think he said they were offered in the phone conversation.
If he said that offered, then I think it's true that he, according to an email that Ms. Christman wrote, she said on the 26th, which was 9 days before the meeting, at that point I explained there was a big envelope of new membership forms that the secretary was entitled to get, but maybe he would rather not have Mary know he had received it, and he agreed he didn't want it. Manipulative, I know, but the guy doesn't function as secretary, wasn't elected. Well, the fact is that this man did not have the right to waive the receipt of the membership names, and furthermore, he didn't get them. They never were entered into the membership list of the corporation until...
How did he acquire the position of secretary?
He was elected by the board, Your Honor, and that's another...
And to what term was he elected?
Under the bylaws, the terms of officers and directors are as long as they stay in office until they're replaced.
And what discretion do the bylaws vest him with in terms of accepting membership applications?
It's silent on that, Your Honor. It would, obviously, we know that the extrinsic evidence was that in the past, every instance in which a membership application was made, the name was put on the membership list.
So no one was ever refused membership?
Correct. But no one was ever not put on the list either. So the company always knew who its members were. And a not-for-profit or any corporation has got to know who its members are in order to function.
So it's 5 days before the election. 75 new membership applications. We're delighted to have them and their money. We're having our election. We invite everybody to the annual meeting. But I'm awfully busy, and I don't get them all entered on the record of the corporation. They don't get to participate in the annual meeting?
No, I think they would in that situation.
So they don't have to be on the list?
No, but the secretary in that case has the names and could at any time put them on the list.
Aren't we entitled from the facts in the record to infer that the existing officers and members who had not conducted business in several years were no longer interested in the operation of the nonprofit, had not paid their dues as required, and therefore there were no members to give notice to or to be subject to?
No, Your Honor. There's no provision in the bylaws that members cease to be a member unless they pay annual dues. And the directors were very busy paying bills, maintaining the facility. During all this time, the place was well maintained. Caretakers were paid. The business of the corporation continued and has today.
Thank you.
So there was never a time where it did not function.
Thank you.